sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. The show you're about to hear today was aired previously. There are now, in May of 2014, 2,188 architects and engineers demanding a new investigation into the events of 9/11. So here's the original show. Today you'll hear the second part of a four-part speech by Michael Rupert called The CIA, Drugs, Wall Street, and the 9/11 Connection. And then I'll be addressing a recent comment made by a listener about the show. So let's get started with the second segment of the speech by Michael Rupert, The CIA, Drugs, Wall Street, and the 9/11 Connection.
So in this context now, we got all this oil built up. Now we got to talk about drugs. If you think about it, oil and drugs have gone hand in hand on almost every major covert paramilitary operation of the U.S. government going back to the Vietnam War. It certainly happened in Iran-Contra. It's a big issue in Colombia, which will be, unfortunately, a stop that we go to in this war that will not end in our lifetimes, according to Dick Cheney. So we have to talk about drugs. Did you know that drugs put about $600, $650, maybe $700 billion a year in liquid cash into the world banking system? You say, okay, fine. What does that mean? Drugs are the financial equivalent of what steroids are to a Major League Baseball player. Drug money is the same power giver. Whoever controls it controls the world economy. You have to understand a little bit about drug cash and how it works. First of all, let me just give you a clue. $600 billion is too big to put under a pillow. You can't put it in a mattress. Matter of fact, most of the world's national economies, it's too big to put in those. Only very large economies can absorb a flow of $600 billion, and there's very good reasons why those countries who are powerful, and of course we are the only superpower, would fight to make sure that they get control of it. I hope you got your seatbelt on here, especially if you own stock. First of all, we know, thanks to Senator Carl Levin, who issued a report in January of 2001, that at least $500 billion in liquid cash gets laundered through this country, that's the banking system and the stock market, every year through correspondent banks. That's conservative estimate on my part because the total flow of criminal money includes more than just drug money, which also includes weapon smuggling, prostitution, human smuggling, counterfeiting, and all the other things that take place. But we know, thanks to the IMF, that there's $1.7 trillion a year total in criminal money. Cash money that gets moved secretly through the world banking system. And this is what the steroid effect is. Now we know, because it's been documented, that banks like Citibank, JP Morgan, Chase, Bank of America, they have all been documented as having laundered large quantities of drug money. In the simplest form, bear in mind that any bank, for every dollar it has on deposit, depending upon its reserve requirements set by the Federal Reserve, can loan or lend between $9 and $15 or $20 based upon its reserve requirements. Now, what happens when they make $20 in loans based upon $1 of drug money in the bank? Those $20 of loans show up on the balance sheets as assets, which get book value, which help determine the bank's stock value and its profitability. Now, the drug money doesn't always show up. And so sometimes, or quite often, it gets put onto the company's net profits. Now, if you own stock, you'll understand what a price-to-earnings ratio is. And a price-to-earnings ratio is not difficult at all. It's very, very simple. To determine a price-to-earnings ratio, it's simply a fraction. The top half of the fraction is market capitalization. The bottom half of the fraction is net profits. What's market capitalization? Market capitalization is if I own a company that has 10,000 shares of stock, and each share of stock is selling for $10, the market capitalization is $100,000. It is simply the share price times the total number of shares in the marketplace. Net profits is the total gross revenues of the company minus the cost of doing business. That's your net profit. So, for example, If I have a company which has a $300 million market capitalization, and I have $10 million in net profits, my price-to-earnings ratio is 30 to 1. Now, most reasonable market analysts will look at a market and say that a healthy price-to-earnings ratio is 15 to 1. And yet we see in this pre-crash or this crashing market in the summer of 2002, companies like Cisco Systems with price-to-earnings of 90 to 1. Enron had a price-to-earnings of 60 to 1. GE, I think, was about 45. Wildly overpriced and not healthy, no matter what they tell you. And we'll get to what the media does and doesn't do here shortly. No matter what they tell you, that's way overpriced. Let's just take a strict mathematical approach to this. If you have a fraction or ratio of 30 over 1, if you make the bottom number a 2, then the top number has to become 60. That's how you keep the relationship. So, stated that way, if you add a dollar of drug profits onto the bottom line, you create 30 extra dollars in stock value on the top line. Now, this doesn't happen automatically. What happens is these market analysts will look at a stock and look at the price to earnings, and they'll see that the net profits are going up, and they'll say this company is underpriced, and they'll put out a buy, and that will drive the stock price up. Catherine Austin Fitz, who is a very dear friend, and she's been my economic mentor, is a former assistant secretary of housing. She's also a former managing director of the Wall Street Investment Bank, Dillon Reed. She's got an MBA from Wharton, and to me, she is an economic Michelangelo, and she and I have been colleagues for a number of years now. She says, this is the way it works. It's called the pop. Now, if companies can sneak drug money onto their bottom lines, in other words, without attaching any cost to that, just inflating their profits, which is what all these cookbook scandals are about, not just drug money, but they were doing it any way they could. Drug money is a prized commodity here. Enron, with a price to earnings of 60 to 1, Enron could have increased their stock value by putting, let's say, $10 million in drug money into their net profits. They could have generated $600 million in stock value. Then, of course, we noticed that all those crooks from all the companies that are now starting to be disclosed pumped their stock prices up, sold the stock, pocketed the money, walked away, and left your pension fund holding the bag. Now, is there any evidence that Enron did such a thing with drug money? Yeah, there certainly is. Enron had 300 subsidiaries in the Cayman Islands. I don't want to surprise you, but there's no oil and gas in the Cayman Islands. Never has been. Enron had thousands of subsidiaries, as a matter of fact, around the globe, and they were the largest money laundering operation in world history. But how ubiquitous is drug money in the stock market? Lowell Bergman of the Public Broadcasting System, he did an okay series in 2000 about the war on drugs. He disclosed that in June of 2000, a group of companies got called in to meet with the Attorney General, Janet Reno, not one of my favorite people, and the Deputy Secretary of the Treasury, Stuart Eisenstadt. And they were called in for laundering drug money. Well, actually, they weren't called in for laundering drug money. They were called in for laundering too much drug money. And who are the companies? Hewlett-Packard, Ford, Sony, General Motors, Whirlpool, General Electric, and Philip Morris. Those are big companies. By the way, in case you didn't know, General Electric owns NBC. And you wonder why they might not be inclined to tell you the full truth about that. Now, you know, I hope, that if you or I walk into a bank with $10,001 in cash, the teller has to fill out a form that says that we might be money launderers. But according to the Banking Secrecy Act, which created an entity called FinCEN, the Financial Criminal Enforcement Network, in 1996, there are certain classes of persons who are exempt from having to report dealing in large, very large quantities of cash. And one of those is a, quote, listed entity other than a bank whose common stock or analogous equity interests are listed on the New York Stock Exchange or American Stock Exchange or are designated as a NASDAQ national market security, which literally means that if you trade your stock on Wall Street, you can drive a ship full of cash up to the bank and deposit it, and nobody can ask you any questions about it. You're exempt. Now, in connection with all of that, before I give you like a major surprise adding to your map of September the 11th, we learned in the course of the Enron investigation that one of the reasons why they, and now 18 or 19 companies, you can do the list yourself, Tyco, Merck, Johnson & Johnson, WorldCom, I mean, there's 18 companies now that have been exposed, probably 20 or 25. We have not yet reached the point of August 14th, 2002, which could be one of the blackest days in corporate history, because that's the deadline that George Bush has set, or the Bush administration has set, for all corporations to restate their earnings if they have misstated them in order to avoid criminal prosecution. And I'll bet you there's going to be a stampede on August the 14th, and we may see another loss in stockholder equity on the order of trillions of dollars on that day. One of the things that allowed all these companies to get away with this creative bookkeeping was the use of a form of bookkeeping called pro forma, which is non-transparent. It allows for all kinds of creative, imaginative manipulations of the books, where you can borrow money and book it as income, where you can double book income twice. If you have a subsidiary company, you can put it on the subsidiary company's books, and you can put it on the corporate books. And it's nuts what they did. And this is called pro forma bookkeeping, as opposed to a form of bookkeeping called generally accepted accounting principles, which is much more transparent, it's much more strict. Well, there's a lot of companies that happen to use pro forma bookkeeping, and we haven't heard much about them. And who do they include? General Electric. Well, GE has been talked about recently. But then we also find AOL Time Warner uses the same kind of bookkeeping. So does Microsoft. So does Viacom, that owns CBS. So does Disney. They own ABC. So does IBM. So does Intel. So does Cisco Systems. So does Sun Micro. So does the Tribune Company, which owns the Chicago Tribune and the Los Angeles Times. So does the Washington Post, which is also Newsweek. And so also does the New York Times. We've now just covered all of the major media in the United States uses the same kind of bookkeeping and feeds at the same financial trough, seeking capital investments of which drug money is the chief prize. And you wonder why they won't tell you the truth about what's going on. In that context now, I issued a bulletin September the 9th. I've only issued two economic alerts to my subscribers. One was September the 9th, 2001. We know what happened 2 days later. The other was July 8th of 2002, and we've seen what's happened to the market since then. What happened that really caught my attention was that in January of 2001, and this is documented by the United Nations, by ABC News, by the Drug Enforcement Administration, everybody caught this and confirmed it. Afghanistan had been the largest producer of the opium poppy, that's where heroin comes from, on the planet. They had produced some 70% of the world's opium supply. Now, the U.S. gets most of its heroin from Colombia. We get about 60% from Colombia and South America, but here's the point, that 70% of the world's opium supply, or 70% of the world's heroin supply, equates to about maybe $200 billion a year in liquid cash. And guess what the Taliban did in January of 2001? They destroyed the entire nation's opium crop. I mean, they left maybe 2%. But that move was a move of economic warfare, and I recognized it when it happened, and I wrote about it in From the Wilderness, and I said, you watch. There's going to be incredible repercussions from that. Now, the planting season in Afghanistan is November, and the harvest for the poppy is May and June. We've just finished the harvest of a crop, and you say, wait a minute. Well, they destroyed the crop in 2001, so that means the crop that was harvested in the summer had to have been planted in November of 2001. And yes, if your history is correct and you have your thinking caps on, boys and girls, you'll recognize that the whole crop that was just harvested was planted after the United States occupied Afghanistan, after the CIA occupied Afghanistan. As a matter of fact, the CIA sprung many opium warlords from prison, and we had a direct relationship with them. We've had that for years. The Soviet conflict of the 80s, there were six heroin labs controlled by one man, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. The CIA has always been in the drug trade, because the CIA's job is to bring the drug money home to Wall Street. And when the Taliban destroyed that crop in January of 2001, they waged a monstrous economic attack on the world banking system, in particular the world banking system that was most dependent upon controlling the drug trade, and that's ours. Some other reasons why drug money is so powerful. Let's say that you want to go buy a company. Some of you may be wealthy enough to do that, but when you get up into the really big fish, the ultimate big mergers like ExxonMobil, BP, Amoco, Shell, RJR, Nabisco, you know, all these big mergers. The merger company that's doing the acquisition has to borrow money. It's called a leveraged buyout. And they have to borrow money to complete the transaction. There are standard ways to borrow money. You could go to JP Morgan, you could go to Bankers Trust, you can go to any of the major, you know, big banks, and you borrow at X percentage rate. Or you can go to, for example, the Cayman Islands, and you can borrow drug money at 2, 3, 4, 5 points less. And anybody who understands international finance knows that those who have the lowest cost of capital win. Put it in better terms, anybody who's ever financed a car and had bad credit knows what the interest rate does to your monthly payment. That's the steroid effect of drug money throughout the world's markets. A lot of the corporate corruption may be due to the fact that major drug lords have wisely bought a lot of stock in American companies. Anyway, leaving all that aside, now we have an oil picture before 9/11 and we have a drug picture before 9/11. Now, do y'all remember when Enron first broke? How our Attorney General, John Ashcroft, stood up like the honorable man that he is, and because he had taken campaign donations from Enron in his 2000 Senate race. And he said, I recuse myself from having anything to do with the Enron investigation. I'm a moral man. We pray every morning at the Department of Justice before we do any work. Well, here's what's interesting. Seymour Hersh, when he wrote the story on the price of oil, disclosed that there are 3 sitting federal grand juries. And what are they looking into? They're looking into the fact that ExxonMobil bribed Nursultan Nazarbayev, who was the president of Kazakhstan, with like $500 million cash. That's a violation of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. They also did the illegal oil swap through Iran. Now, we got 1 sitting grand jury in New York looking at the bribery and 2 in Washington that are looking at the swap. And they're investigating ExxonMobil and BP Amoco. And would you be surprised to know that ExxonMobil and BP Amoco, well, ExxonMobil gave more money to John Ashcroft's Senate race than Enron did. But John Ashcroft hasn't recused himself from that grand jury. And he's not supposed to have anything to do with that grand jury, but we published a story called The Elephant in the Living Room, which is on my website, showing very clearly that John Ashcroft has been mucking around in the grand juries. And BP Amoco also gave him a lot of money, and he has not recused himself from that either. As a matter of fact, he has criminal conflicts of interest. And there may be a really good reason why John Ashcroft needs to do everything he can do to keep people from looking into those grand juries and focusing on the Central Asian oil and the fact that all the oil companies and the American political interests were just dying to get into Central Asia and they had to have a war to do it. One of the keys to unlocking that particular puzzle and understanding is that, of course, when the bribes to buy equity in Kazakh oil, oil that belongs to the nation of Kazakhstan, the agreements had to be completed and approved by the Kazakh government state oil advisory board. So also did the illegal oil swap through Iran. I'm really going to surprise you when I tell you that sitting on the Kazakh government state-owned oil advisory board when the bribes took place and when the illegal oil swap took place was none other than the chairman and chief executive officer of Halliburton, Dick Cheney, who is currently our vice president. This has been probably one of the biggest constitutional issues raging since even before September the 11th. Dick Cheney held very secret talks on the Vice President's Energy Development Task Force, which was his oil and energy task force, secret meetings funded by Congress where we know Enron got in, and I have shown in my stories that ExxonMobil and BP Amoco got in. The New York Times has admitted that. So when you have now criminal co-conspirators in the bribery and the illegal oil swap getting access to a secret vice presidential task force on oil, that's the moral and ethical equivalent of having Manuel Noriega consulting on the war on drugs. Now, Vice President Cheney has broken the Constitution. He has refused to disclose all of the records. The Bush administration has put down their feet and they will not tell because therein, folks, lies one of the biggest keys to unlocking September 11th. What were they talking about in the Vice President's Energy Task Force when the Vice President, under law and by definition of law, Richard Cheney is a legitimate target of these grand juries? And now he's broken the law by refusing to tell us what they were talking about pre-9/11. Now I think I want to talk a little bit about another reason
that is emerging as being critical in the developments around 9/11 and in the world since 9/11. I have to be very clear that I have said that as of September the 11th, 2001, the whole world is living in a whole new paradigm. The whole world has changed, never to be the same as it was again. And I heard a great definition from a friend of mine, Dr. Faiz Khan, in New York City. He said, a paradigm is what you think about something before you think about it. And that's probably the best description of a paradigm that I've ever heard. And we're living in a whole new paradigm. And here's another huge piece of it that is growing stronger and more apparent as time passes. That is the fact that the American economy and the American treasury is being systematically looted. And I say that very clearly. Anybody with money in the stock market knows that more than $1 trillion in stockholder equity has disappeared. We had a post 9/11 high of about 10,600, and now we're at, about 8,600 estimating, more than 2,000 points off the Dow. And that's come out of pension funds. The California Employee Retirement System has 90% of its pension fund invested in the stock market. That's pretty shocking. You hear the news reports now, the baby boomers may not be retiring until they're 70 or 80. Well, gee, but it's much, much deeper and more serious than that. You didn't know some of what I'm about to tell you. First of all, let's talk a little bit about Social Security. You know, by the way, that the Bush administration is by and large a reconstitution of the first Reagan-Bush administration, which brought us the savings and loan scandal that took $500 billion out of people's pockets. Only now that they've had their sights on much bigger things. And one of the things that they have their sights on is Social Security. In the 2000 presidential campaign, candidate Bush swore that he would only tap into Social Security in the event of war, recession, or national emergency. And he was quoted by his budget director in the Miami Herald, Mitch Daniel, on September 11th as having said, "Lucky me, I hit the trifecta." That's Bush's attitude toward your Social Security. And do you know that in 2001 alone, that's the last 3 months, according to USA Today and Washington Post, the Bush administration took $34 billion out of the Social Security Trust Fund?
That was the second part of a speech by Michael Rupert called "The CIA, Drugs, Wall Street, and the 9/11 Connection." Even though this speech was given in 2002, I think it's highly relevant to understanding what's going on today in the financial realm and in making those connections between the CIA, drugs, Wall Street, and how 9/11 made it possible for the neocons to move their agenda forward. You'll hear the third installment of the speech next week. If you want to learn more about Michael Rupert and his work, you can go to his website, fromthewilderness.com. You can also read his book, Crossing the Rubicon, which came out in 2004 and covers in great detail the same topics, the CIA, drugs, Wall Street, and the 9/11 connection. Michael Rupert has shifted his focus in the past few years to our economic collapse. His website is collapsenet.com. He's also made a movie called Collapse. After the airing of the first part of Michael Rupert's speech last week, we had a listener respond, in part criticizing my show for dealing with, quote, conspiracy theories. I want to thank that listener for taking the time to comment on the show. And I would also like to take a moment to address the term conspiracy theory. So first, let's start with the definition of a conspiracy. A conspiracy is an agreement to perform together an illegal, treacherous, or evil act. Another definition is planning and acting together secretly, especially for an unlawful or harmful purpose, such as murder or treason. So based on those definitions of a conspiracy, the official story of 9/11 with 19 Middle Eastern men, led by Osama bin Laden, is also a conspiracy theory. So the question becomes, which conspiracy theory, the government's official conspiracy theory of what happened on 9/11, or the 9/11 Truth Movement's research and what they put forward as could have possibly happened or what we know didn't happen, which one has the evidence to support it? That's the real question. In the 9 years that I've been researching the events of 9/11, I have found that the official conspiracy theory of these events is not supported in any way by the evidence. And I've also found that there is an abundance of evidence that there's a cover-up going on. And that the three World Trade Center towers were brought down by controlled demolition, and that the official conspiracy theory can't possibly be true. That's where the evidence takes you if you choose to examine it. Since 9/11 and the ensuing war on terror have been used and continue to be used to justify the many wars we're involved in, the attack on our civil liberties, torture, an executive power grab, and the list goes on, it's important that every American examine the evidence. And when you do the research, you have to use alternative sources. If you just use the corporate or more established media, you'll only hear the official conspiracy theory repeated. To keep it simple, I would suggest you start with the website 911truth.org. They have a wealth of information there, and they also have links to many of the other websites that have valuable information. Another website I would recommend is the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth site, which is ae911truth.org, and they have a lot of the scientific evidence there, videos, films, etc., that you can check out. And as for books, I would recommend Michael Ruppert's Crossing the Rubicon and any of David Ray Griffin's many books on the subject, but The New Pearl Harbor and The New Pearl Harbor Revisited are good places to start. And now I'd like to read a portion of David Ray Griffin's book, The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, and here goes. Not only Coburn's Counterpunch, but also most of the other major left-leaning publications, such as The Nation, The Progressive, and In These Times, have remained impervious to the fact that, as more and more people with professional expertise examine the evidence, they reject the official story. A case in point is former senior CIA official Bill Christison, who wrote in the summer of 2006, quote, I spent the first 4.5 years since September 11 utterly unwilling to consider seriously the conspiracy theories surrounding the attacks of that day. In the last half year, and after considerable agony, I've changed my mind, unquote. On the basis of that change of mind, Christison wrote an essay entitled Stop Belittling the Theories About September 11, in which he said, quote, I now think there is persuasive evidence that the events of September did not unfold as the Bush administration and the 9/11 Commission would have us believe, unquote. Robert Baer is another former CIA official who changed his mind. Late in 2004, he wrote a review of New Pearl Harbor for The Nation, in which he faulted me for recycling some of the wilder conspiracy theories. The attacks, Baer assured his readers, were best explained in terms of a confluence of incompetence, spurious assumptions, and self-delusion on a grand scale. By 2006, however, a closer examination of the evidence had led him to question his former position. Asked by interviewer Tom Hartman whether there was an aspect of inside job to 9/11 within the U.S. government, Baer replied, there is that possibility. The evidence points at it. These changes of mind by Christison and Baer have, however, apparently not led The Nation or any of the other left-leaning magazines to reconsider their stances on 9/11. It was, in fact, months after Baer's public statement that The Nation published Coburn's 9/11 Conspiracy Nuts. These magazines have also thus far seemed unfazed by the large number of scientists, pilots, architects, engineers, and military and intelligence officers who have publicly rejected the official conspiracy theory in favor of the view that 9/11 was, at least in part, an inside job. While recognizing that the Bush administration has lied about almost everything else, they continue to accept on faith the fantastic tale about 9/11 told by this administration. While, without irony, referring to the growing rejection of that tale as, quote, the 9/11 faith movement, unquote. I keep hoping, however, that the press will finally get empirical about this issue, rather than continuing to dismiss the alternative theory on a priori grounds, a plea I made in a lecture called 9/11, Let's Get Empirical. As Christison and hundreds of other professionals have illustrated, once people actually examine the evidence, the fact that 9/11 was an inside job becomes pretty obvious. For the listener who criticized my show for dealing with conspiracy theories, I would like to make a request. If you haven't already done this research of the evidence presented by the over 1,500 architects and engineers and other scholars who have been researching 9/11 over the past 10 years, please do so. You might be unpleasantly surprised at what you discover. I was in your shoes once, thinking that the 9/11 truthers were just crazy. But then I examined the research, and here I am. And thanks again for contacting the station with your comments on the show. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.